Well, you just can't make these things up. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Yeah, glad to be with you today. It's good to be back doing a program. Unfortunately, we can't do it face-to-face, so if it sounds a little funny, it's because we're doing it by the miracle of Skype.
It's been a while since we've done Skype, but the way things kind of flow this week, we decided it would be better to Skype than to run a special or a best of, because, you know, Chuck, sometimes, even though it's slow in the summertime and people, you know, want to set back and, you know, kick back a little bit, there are still interesting things going on. We know in the world scene, we've got uproars with airliners being shot down. You know, nationally here, we have uproars over, you know, whether or not the president has authority to, by executive order, thwart a decision of the U.S. Supreme Court and the will of Congress. But here locally and in the state of Ohio, we've got a number of things going on as well, too. But as we looked across our backgrounding here that we usually do getting ready for a program in the week, we couldn't help but notice that a number of these items, a number of these news reports, all kind of carried a very similar theme, and that is they seem to be a slightly preposterous, and therefore you probably just can't make these things up.
Well, yeah. A fiction writer couldn't possibly, you know, a Saturday Night Live or SCTV or whoever your favorite satire writer is, probably couldn't come up with this stuff. It's almost too silly to believe.
Oh, absolutely. And some of it is based in some seriousness, obviously, because, you know, we live in some serious times. There's a lot of things that are happening in our world and in our economy and in our culture that really are no laughing matters. But, you know, we wanted to take a moment here as we're going into the last weekend in July, and people are, you know, kind of winding down from their summer plans, and we're focusing in toward getting back to school and getting back to, you know, full-time work and dealing with the exigencies of life. And, of course, you know, we also have a major election coming up, at least major for the state of Ohio. It's not a national election, but all of our statewide offices and all the House and half the Senate and a lot of local races are up for election this year. So there's a lot of things going on. But one of the things, you know, we want to talk, we want to pull out some of these ideas, pull out some of these things and kind of give you somewhat of a little lighthearted motive. Now, we're going to start a little bit more serious because there was an article, Chuck, in the Tuesday's Columbus Dispatch written by Jack Torrey, who's a political writer for the Dispatch. And he's talking about efforts one of your local Central Ohio congressmen is trying to make in order to get tough with Russian Premier and President Vladimir Putin. That congressman is Pat Tiberi, and if I remember correctly, Charles, isn't he your congressman?
I'm sad to report that he is indeed my congressman.
Okay. Well, his idea, Congressman Tiberi's idea, is in order to put pressure on President Putin to, you know, back off of the Crimea and the Ukraine and all the other areas in which Russia is starting to press an advantage, is that we will get the other European countries to back economic sanctions against Russia. Now, how are we going to do that, Chuck?
Well, I have to laugh about this. We're going to do that by attempting to take on Russia in the international market by exporting natural gas.
Right, to those European countries. In other words, right. Really, even though I'm sure that he would deny that he ever meant it this way, a form of national bribery in order to get them to back the will of the United States against Vladimir Putin. Now, I think that's, you know, like I said, Chuck, this is a very serious subject, and honestly, utilizing trade situations in order to back political or policy objectives has been a long-standing practice in the United States in our government, going all the way back to the first government of George Washington. But I this is where, folks, that you listen to our program, because we're going to unbolt this a little bit. You see, that sounds really good now, doesn't it, Chuck? You know, we're going to get tough. We're going to put economic sanctions against Russia because they're doing something that we in the United States have said we don't like. In other words, they moved into the Crimea and Ukraine area, and they're basically almost, it looks like, trying to re-centralize the old Soviet Union. Now, you know, when the Cold War is over, you know, when the wall came down in Eastern Europe, during Reagan's era, that was kind of considered the end of the Cold War era, because there was, you know, more freedom and more openness coming to the Eastern European countries and that bloc. But Chuck, you know, as you look at that map, when those countries broke apart from the Soviet Union, many of those countries now have name extensions that end with Stan.
Right.
Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, which means that they are majority Muslim controlled countries. Vast majority of them are. So what we're saying is, or Pat Tiberi is saying, is we're going to use natural gas exports as incentives. Let's use the word that he would use. Incentives to our Eastern European fellow nations to encourage those countries to back economic sanctions. I should have said Eastern. Actually, it's Western European that we're going to be sending the gas to, in order to get them to back economic sanctions against Russia. Now, again, I understand that people are really upset right now. You know, you had a Malaysian jetliner that got shot down. Now it's starting to look like that might have been an oops moment by the military there in that fight that they're having, that they shot down what they thought was a fighter plane or a military plane, and turned out to be a commercial civilian jet, which had one American citizen on board. Now, I understand that, you know, we have to stand up for and defend American citizens. However, I'm not sure this quite gets it done. And the reason why I want to talk about this is because we need to look at what the potential impacts are on many other American citizens.
Well, there are a lot of bogus arguments with that. First of all, let's talk about what that Stan thing means.
Sure.
Believe it or not, the meaning, it doesn't necessarily imply Muslim. It means literally the land of. In other words, Pakistan is the land of the Paks.
Okay.
Afghanistan is the land of the Afghans. And it comes from Persian culture. Any place that's been touched by Persian culture, very often the areas would be named the land of something, you know, the land of bright and shining, you know, blah blah blah. Very often, sometimes the names were applied ironically. Sometimes the names were applied on a true character of the land. It just depends. Now, are most of those countries Islam dominated? Yeah, they are.
Sure,
you can't escape that. Now let's talk about this whole. There's a lot of falsehoods about this whole Ukrainian Russian. That somehow the Russians are responsible because some Ukrainian rebels who want to rehook with with Russia are at fault. And the reasons given are that somehow because Russian equipment was being used, and, you know, were Russians giving them advice? Probably, but were they giving them direct? Did the Russians come out and say, you better shoot down a civilian airliner? Well, the Russians aren't that stupid. The Russians would not have told the Ukrainian rebels to shoot down a Malaysian airliner. In fact, the reports that came out immediately were they were bragging about it, beating their chests about how they brought down a cargo jet. Well, once Ukrainian rebels figured out that they had not brought down a cargo jet, but a passenger liner, well, we didn't really do that. Okay. Barry, if countries that supply equipment are responsible for the things that get done with that equipment, then the United States is in big trouble.
Oh, deep trouble. Now, I think it's interesting you mention that. First of all, thank you for the history lesson, because I was basically shorthanding a point, but I'm glad you unpacked that and gave us a little bit of a background on how those countries came about getting those names. And it is, you know, there is some the factuality that many of those countries are dominated by Muslim populations now and Muslim governments. But kind of moving forward with what you're saying, Seabury is noted in this article by Jack Torrey in the Dispatch saying, quote, "Everybody knows that Russia has this huge hammer over Europe because of their natural gas exports." Now, again, this is another situation, I think, where, okay, are we basically saying, you know, Russia controls all of Europe? Is that what Pat Seabury is actually trying to get us to believe? And he's upset because President Obama hasn't used a trade war in order to promulgate an offensive against the Putin regime.
Well, of course, there are, believe it or not, there are some people out there beating the drum for war against Russia, and I'm laughing at this. I'm like, well, I made the comment to someone the other day, let's ask Napoleon and Hitler how well that worked out.
Yeah, no doubt.
Land wars against Russia would be idiocy. They have something like one-fifth of the entire surface of dry land on the world as their country. That, you know, you might be able to invade and occupy parts of it. Getting the whole nation, that's never going to happen. It's sort of like trying to invade China. How do you invade a country that's got 1 billion people in it, size notwithstanding? It's not going to happen. The other thing is we're going to ignite a trade war. Well,
oh, absolutely,
Barry. This is stupid. I mean, this is stupidity beyond normal stupidity. The United States of America, and we're going to do it with natural gas. Well, first of all, we're going to undercut Russia, which has pipelines that run into Europe directly from their from their fields. We're going to do it with ships that are going to ship it over there. This is not going to happen. First of all, Russia is the number one in the world with the amount of natural gas reserves.
Right, exactly.
The grand total in the world is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. This is a 15-0 in cubic meters. 15-0 kind of deal.
Yeah, that's getting into, what would that be, quintillion?
Let's see, 15. Every three.
Six is a million, nine is a billion, 12 is a trillion. 15 is a quadrillion.
Yeah, so 187 quadrillion, 300 quintillion is the world's total. Of that, Russia has 48 quintillion, 700 quadrillion. The United States has about 9. So let's put it this way. Russia has about 25% of the world's resources.
Yeah. Now, again, you would think that somebody in Pat Seabury's office would have done some math on this. Because here's his quote. He says, "Well, we have this natural gas boom in America. We can use this newfound energy as a diplomatic tool to give the European leaders some backbone in standing up to the Russians." Chuck, in order for that to make a significant dent, and actually put enough calcium in there to actually form a one spinal disc, we would probably have to ship about 70% of what of these new gas, natural gas energy pockets that we're finding to Europe in order to compete against Russia, who obviously, if that's the case, would more than likely start dumping more on Western Europe in order to keep them mollified and keep their prices down below what we could trade with them for.
This is the height of stupidity, that basically we're going to negate all the transportation costs. Now, I'm going to ask you a question. Who's going to end up if we subsidized all the costs that would be involved in dumping all this gas in Western Europe,
which we probably will, according to federal statute,
who's going to pay for it?
Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah.
And that's where it affects a whole lot more of the American public than one person in the Malaysian airliner.
And that's exactly right. And now let me ask you another question. This is kind of a personal question. You don't have to answer it if you don't want to. Are you on a natural gas line? Because I am.
Oh, yes. Yes, I am too.
Have you
noticed? Actually, it's not LNG. It's propane. Yeah. We use propane for heating here at the house.
Well, okay. Different, but not all that much different. And it has to do with, I've looked at what the price of natural gas is, and despite all these reserves that we're finding, I'm not seeing the price come down. In fact, I've seen our price go up significantly.
I think the last time we had a fill up, it was over $2.30 a gallon.
Yeah, see, yours is measured in gallons. We're measured in 100 cubic feet, but
100 cubic feet, yes.
It's 148 gallons. Hold on, I've got an expert in the room.
I think it's 748 gallons per 1 cubic foot.
Jenny says it's 748 gallons of natural gas per 100 cubic feet.
Okay.
So this is my wife, folks, and she pays bills for companies who buy utilities. So she has to know that kind of stuff. So thank you, consultant. We appreciate it.
Your check is in the mail.
Yes, that's it. We'll write you a check for our mass profits that come out of the show. The fact is that the price is going up. What will this do? Not only then will we be paying to subsidize the sale of this natural gas that we're not getting here, that's being shipped overseas. What will that do to the supply here? Well, it'll put a serious kink in the supply chain, and anytime you put a kink in the supply chain, what does that do to the cost of the commodity?
Oh, it increases it almost exponentially.
Yeah, exactly. So we're going to be paying on both ends of this. We're going to be paying mm-hmm. to ship our natural gas to someone else who can do the job better than we can. We're going to waste the resources to ship it.
Yes.
Overseas in an era when we're talking about trying to find ways to save energy. And we're going to pay through the nose because that commodity is now in a state of shortage.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and there you have another aspect to this, and that is, let's say, because right now, according to this article by Tory, that Europe, other than the Ukraine, imports about 30% of its gas from Russia, okay? That means 70% they get from other sources. Probably some domestic.
I could tell you probably where from Iran, because Iran is like right. Number two. Iran or Iraq, although Iraq is in chaos.
Right. And of course, they also are getting it from the United States because we have been shipping those commodities to Western friendly countries, pro-Western governments in Europe. But not at any quantities that would considerably impact or influence their policy decisions with their near neighbor Russia. So this is where, you know, Pat Tiber is pushing for this. The House last month approved a bill to speed up federal approval of the exports to gas. But the problem is, the places where it would do the most good, like the Ukraine and other areas, are not free trade agreement countries with the United States, and therefore there's a significant difficulty in moving those commodities to those countries, i.e. Pat Tiberi's idea of, well, let's go to the Western European countries and get them to exert pressure on Russia by reducing how much, and this is how that economic sanction works. If we sell them gas at a rate where we're probably going to end up having to subsidize it ourselves, in order to get it underneath what Russia can get it to them for, that they will reduce the amount that they get from Russia, and therefore that will hurt Russia's economy, and therefore they will have to back off of their militaristic empire building. And I'm not saying that T-Berry said this directly, but that's kind of the line of the thinking. As a matter of fact, as we've shown, there's going to be problems here in the United States with doing that, because we would have to ship such a significant quantity that it would create supply chain problems or supply flow problems here in the United States. And Chuck, honestly, the fact is, in this country, if we had a limited amount of supply and the prices go up, as we've seen them do, and last winter we had a big situation where they were having problems getting propane to places because of the weather, and we saw prices going up over $3 a gallon and you know, having to schedule and getting gas like 2, 3, 4 weeks out.
Yeah.
You know, that's a situation we run into. But the big problem is, you know, we've got a lot of residential and commercial properties who use natural gas in this country, and many of them, especially the businesses, are not going to stand quietly as prices go to the $3 and $4 a 100 cubic foot range, or whatever it might be for 100 cubic feet of natural liquefied natural gas. And they're going to put pressure on their elected officials, i.e., Pat T-Berry and others, to do something about it. Well, if you've locked into trade agreements with European countries and you've promised to supply them X amount of your supply of natural gas, what are you going to do when your constituency starts pounding the drum that they need you to get the price down?
Well, we've got another issue. We're starting to run into the law of unintended consequences.
Well, that's true too.
As always happens in these situations. You know, everybody's got a brilliant strategic plan that takes almost nothing except their little tunnel vision thing into consideration. The fact is that a lot of people who are currently heating with things like natural gas are going to look for an alternative source. Now, what are the alternative sources? Well, kerosene, electric. But we're in a problem in this country in that we've now shut down a whole bunch of electric generation because of basically draconian EPA regulation. Coal-fired power plants are being shut down all over the place, yep, especially along the Ohio River.
Yes, tell me about it. As that's where I live.
Things are going to be much, much cleaner. Yes, but we don't have enough electricity to run the things that we've become used to. In other words, it's a lucky thing that this is a very cool summer. And by the way, I have to laugh. The International Panel on Climate Change says this is the hottest, the two hottest months on record were the last 2 months. And I'm, well, not in the Midwest.
Well, their records don't go that far, and they're just probably still getting their calibrations from asphalt covered airport parking lots.
That's part of it, but that's a sideline.
Which
we'll talk about with someone we'll get to interview on that at one of these days. But
yeah,
in any case, we're shutting down these power plants. Where are people going to turn for heat? You can't go to electricity because there isn't that much left on the grid. There isn't enough on the grid to do everything we need to do now.
Well, you've also got wood-based as well because, you know, we have these wood pellet burning furnaces and things of that nature that people are going to have to do. But again, a lot of people, you know, especially residentially, you know, if you're on propane or natural gas, you're already, you know, you've got that kind of a furnace, you're hooked into that. That's going to be hard changing that out, and it's going to be expensive.
It's going to be $8,000 to change your furnace out. Yeah.
Right. But a bigger problem is, Chuck, when all these people and all these businesses start howling and moaning, it's going to be elected officials like Pat T-Berry who are going to be like, well, we need to import our natural gas from other countries. Now, who would we be importing them from, Chuck? Canada?
Okay.
South America?
Let me tell you, all those places are way down on the list of reserves.
Oh, I know. But those would be the quickest ones to get some supply from.
Mexico.
But then again, those places, we would have to end up in trade agreements with them and import more. And so what does that do to our economy?
Well, importation is expensive.
It's usually more expensive than what you get on exporting, especially if you're subsidizing the exports in order to move a political agenda.
Yeah. Now, see, I'm looking on the list to see where countries that we might purchase from are. Mexico's number 37 on the list of possible. And that's a place where we could lay pipelines if we needed to pump it directly into the system.
Let's look at what the top five are.
Okay, the top five. Russia.
Yes.
Iran.
Ah, well, we're not going to be doing that.
Iran.
Oh, well, see, we have a little problem there.
Qatar.
Well, you know what? We just cut a great big deal, and we gave them lots and lots of money here just the other day. The president did. I think it was somewhere in the neighborhood of, I shouldn't say the number because I just saw the article. I'll have to pull it up. But Qatar, we just actually cut a deal with.
All right. Turkmenistan.
Another majority Islamic country.
Yep. And the United States is number five.
Okay, well, skip the U.S. because we know we can't import things from ourselves.
Number six is Saudi Arabia.
Oh, the Saudis. Okay, so we're going to give more strength over our economy to countries who already have us in a hammer lock.
Yeah, exactly.
In order to put Vladimir Putin into a hammer lock that we can't throw. Because we, as you said, we're number five and Russia's number one.
We're creating all kinds of bad strategic leverage. Now, let's just for fun, yes. Look at number seven. But, let's look at number seven, Venezuela.
Okay.
Venezuela.
Okay. Oh, yeah, great bastion of democracy there.
So we're creating all kinds of, we would create all kinds of, again, the law of unintended consequences. You're upsetting the apple cart. Basically, the United States currently supplies its own needs with gas. So,
yes.
In order to create some kind of quote-unquote strategic advantage, we're going to undercut another country that has the number one reserve in the world. Okay. Stupid is as stupid does in the words of Forrest Gump. And honestly, Barry, I can't think of anything more stupid.
Now, Charles, I'm going to have to chide you now. And I'm doing this as an avatar for Congressman T. Barry because you're just not being patriotic. because, and this is the quote from the congressman at the end of this article by Jack Tory, quote, "We are dealing with a really bad guy who doesn't like the United States and is exerting his influence in a very negative way to freedom-loving people. There are thousands of innocent people who are being killed because of it." So, Charles, I guess you're bringing up facts and truth, and us looking at the deeper aspects of it makes us unpatriotic because, you know what, he's a bad guy and he's killing people, and so therefore we just got to do it.
Well, I think
it is what it is.
I would answer that by saying I think it's incredibly not patriotic to give strategic advantages to our people who we are at loggerheads with in the world by creating an economic situation in the United States that may be unrecoverable. And we are in a precarious situation. And to those who would play the patriotism card, I would just say, so you think really that subsidizing natural gas trade in the top seven other countries besides ourselves is strategically and patriotically wise? All those countries have interests that are in conflict with the United States, some of them very strongly in conflict with the United States. At this point, Russia has really done nothing. They didn't march into, for instance, this whole Crimea thing started Ukraine thing started when Crimea pulled out of the Ukraine and reunited with Russia. And the whole Ukraine thing really was sort of it's an artificial separation. Ukraine has been in and out of alliance with Russia for centuries, having been under the domination domination of the Turks and also the Russians, and they have much more affinity with the Russians, but they want to remain a sovereign nation, and I'm like, I'm fine with that, remain a sovereign nation, but the problem.
I thought self-actualization and self-determination were qualities that we were trying to engender in these countries, and isn't that the reason why we go in and instill and promote democracy in these countries?
Well, Barry, I would point out that secession is a bad thing. All you have to do is ask anybody who knows anything about the war between the states.
Okay, all right. By the way, just on a quick side note, I found what I was looking for. We just sold $11 billion worth of Patriot missile parts and Apache attack helicopters to Qatar. That just happened here this week, as a matter of fact. So, again, one of the other countries we'd have to go to for natural gas, we just sold a significant amount of military hardware to. And this is a country that a number of various think tanks are saying are passing private funds to groups like ISIS.
Yeah, yeah. This should shock no one. So once again, the United States is funding both sides of a war.
Right.
And
I said, you can't make this stuff up.
No.
That's our theme today. You cannot make this stuff up.
And
you also can't make up the fact that Pat Tiberi seems to be, now maybe because the interview wasn't deep enough, he might understand some of these things. It just sounds like he just doesn't care, and he thinks that this is a great way to, you know, flex a little muscle and get Vladimir Putin to fall back on his heels and cry uncle.
Well, look, that's not going to happen. Putin basically appears to be a very good poker player. And he seems to have been dealt a very strong hand in this situation. And, I mean, let's face it, the guy's ex-KGB. He's not stupid. He's well-versed in how what the Germans call Weltpolitik,
mm-hmm.
which is basically looking at the and remember that Russians are excellent chess players, which means they look at the whole board. Unfortunately, what's happened here is that Pat Tiberi is only looking at part of the board. And the United States has been guilty of only looking at part of the board, while Putin is looking at the whole board. He gets the picture of what can be done, and he would love it if we were to do this to ignite this trade war, because he's got the resources to make us look like idiots in this thing. Yeah. How much can we subsidize our natural gas to make it so attractive that they will close off the pipeline from Russia to Western Europe and only take it in from on the pipelines that are laid out at the ports to bring it off our ships or whoever ships? Let's face it, whose ships are going to get used to transport the stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Chances are they're not flying under a U.S. flag.
No, they could be flying under a Chinese flag. They could be flying under French flags. They could be flying under any type of flag.
Panamanian.
Japanese. Yep. You name it.
There's a lot of countries whose flags merchant ships fly under because of the tax and regulatory situation. I'm trying to think. There's a couple of African countries. So basically, there's all kinds of considerations that aren't being made, that at least that we know of, in this proposal.
Oh, and I'm not saying we have all of the background of the proposal either.
Right.
But it really sounds that Pat Tiberi, in coming out publicly to make it sound like he's being patriotic and tough on a really bad guy, I'm going to use his phrase, is advocating for something that I don't think he's actually looked at the long-term domestic consequences of.
Exactly. And not to be too cruel to Pat Tebray, but that's not all that shocking to me, having watched him in his career. I would be curious, and I have not seen any reaction from anyone else on things like the Foreign Relations Committee,
mm-hmm.
in Congress, or any of the foreign relations guys on the committee in the Senate. As far as I know, there nobody is has made a comment on his comments. I'd be willing to bet that the reaction would not be friendly.
Possibly not. But again, you know, Chuck, that kind of leads us right into our next thing. And again, you just can't make these things up.
No.
Did you know that? And that's the reason why Pat's probably glad that Congress is going to be having a little bit of a break here in the month of August to come back home, because in Ohio, it's now the era of good feeling. And we say that because yesterday the Ohio State Fair opened on the fairgrounds there in Columbus, and our own governor, John Kasich, was visiting the fair for the opening, and of course to stand up there and give the speech at the ribbon cutting. And he declared that it's an era of good feeling in Ohio. So we have the official pronouncement from Governor Kasich that we are now in the era of good feeling. Now, Chuck, if you were Pat Tebray and you knew you weren't going to get a great reception from your colleagues, wouldn't you want to come home and come into the era of good feeling?
Oh, yes. Oh, by all means, except for the fact that historically there is a period in our country's history called the era of good feelings. And what's interesting about that is that apparently it was applied kind of ironically, because there was a lot of internal strife and division and kind of bad feelings during the era of now, good feelings.
Yeah, you mean the original historic. You see, folks, because that phrase, that catchphrase, actually describes a time in our American history that was known as the era of good feeling, and it was around the administration of
James Monroe.
James Monroe, right?
Yeah. A president that not many people actually know about. Here's a little bit of trivia. He's the only president besides Washington. Let's put it this way. He got every electoral vote except one. And the reason he didn't get that one vote was because somebody left didn't vote for him so that Washington would still be the only president who was elected unanimously.
Mm-hmm.
So that doesn't mean necessarily that he was as popular as Washington. What it means is he got that many electoral votes because the electoral system was already starting to be rigged. There was only one political party.
Yes.
And that was his party. This was the beginning of what they called the second party system. And there was only one political party. But for instance, when Monroe was elected president, there were four candidates running on the same party, which seems right. odd to us today because we don't understand how that was all set up to work. But that being said, I don't like to go to Wikipedia very often, but I'm going to go to Wikipedia because it's good shorthand history about something that, you know, we can lay out in kind of a shorthand way. I'm going to quote from that article on the era of good feelings from Wikipedia.
Sure.
Quote, the designation of the period by historians as one of quote-unquote good feelings is often conveyed with irony or skepticism, as the history of the era was one in which the political atmosphere was strained and divisive, especially among factions within the Monroe administration and the Republican Party.
Again, you just can't make these things up.
No, you can't, Perry. And
honestly, I'm not sure John Kasich knew the historical weight or importance of him using that exact phrase to comment on what's happening in Ohio right now. Because his idea, And these are in quotes. This was an article by Joe Varden in the Dispatch on Thursday, so that would have been today as we're recording this. It says, quote, "I think people feel good about the state, and that's what matters the most," unquote. It doesn't matter that we have, you know, people out at work and, you know, healthcare system out of whack. It doesn't matter. But if you feel good about things, that matters the most. And then he says, "When people feel positive and good about the way things are, that's what makes me feel good," unquote. Elections come and people feel good. It's something where they say, "We're happy with the way things are. I can tell you, you just walk around with me for a while and see what people have to say," unquote. Okay, Chuck, what he's really saying is, I don't think people are going to vote me out of office this time around because they think everything's hunky-dory.
They're not mad enough at me to vote me out.
And it's an election year. And so when they feel good, that makes me happy because he can continue to be governor.
Well, not only that, but the Democrats basically don't have anybody that makes them feel any better. The idea that somehow everyone's happy with what's going on in Ohio is kind of belied by some of the other things that are going on in the state. That I'm going to let you broach those subjects when the time comes. But some other things that you and I have been looking at in the news.
Yeah.
And the fact is that people aren't really all that happy. Unfortunately, right now, there is no viable alternative. I mean, we had people who were set up to run in opposition to Kasich, who the Republican Party managed to manipulate. I'm going to pull no punches on this. The Republican Party manipulated the Supreme Court into and the legislature into maneuvering so that these people had no ballot access. And one of those people was a guy who I've met and I really like, and he and I gave a speech. Apparently, the people who set up the speech thought we were in opposition to one another, and it turned out we were basically all in line with each other's programs, and that was Charlie Earle. Charlie Earle, a former state legislator, was going to be an independent candidate for governor, and had a lot of support, and basically, the legislature came in, made sure that the law got changed so Earl couldn't get ballot access, and the Supreme Court basically also set it up so that Earl couldn't have access. Because, I mean, after all, we have to get John Kasich reelected. Well, if that's the way they've got to work things to get John Kasich reelected, then he's not as popular as he says he is here.
Oh, no, I think that's, you know, they just had an announcement. There were like 246,000 jobs created in Ohio. In other words, so they're saying jobs are going up in Ohio. Now, that's interesting, Charles, because if you look at it, Ohio is wrestling with how we're going to pay off extended unemployment compensation. 246,000 jobs, yes. I'll give the state credit. They have been actively trying to seek and lure companies into Ohio. But that's the job of every governor, is to lure business and economic growth into a state in order to be successful and to keep the budgets balanced if they can. But I think that possibly they're looking a little too – I think it's not quite whistling past the graveyard, but I think it's being a little bit too rose-colored glasses firmly attached to your face to say that it's an era of good feeling in the state of Ohio, because I believe that there are some other things, and you had mentioned we're going to talk about that. You know, here's one right here that there was just a suit that was settled here in Ohio between the Bureau of Workers' Compensation, in other words, part of the Kasich administration, we can't blame them for it because this was things that happened during the Taft administration. So from 2001 to 2009, businesses were overcharged. Hundreds of thousands of employers were overcharged workers' compensation premiums, and to the point where the state has just now agreed to create a fund of $420 million to pay claims of employers who were overcharged. Now, Chuck, you're one of those small businesses who for years has been paying exorbitant workers' compensation fees. How does that impact you hiring employees?
Oh, are you kidding? Basically, it's one of those expenses, and there are a number of them. Unemployment compensation insurance, which actually isn't too bad right now, but workers' comp is one of those things that keeps you from hiring people. I have two employees, and at one point I was paying just in a family business, and you know what that means. Nobody ever collects disability on a family business. If they have to wheel you down the steps in a wheelchair and set up a thing, you know, your office is in your basement. If they have to set up a thing where you ride a little thing down those steps to get to your office, that's what you do. You go to work. If your back is all crippled up, you go to work. If you, right. If you chop an arm off, you go to work. Once you've recovered to the point where, you know, you can get to work, you go to work. We were paying over $3,500 a year for, and had never had a claim, and we're never going to have a claim. That's the problem with workers' compensation. It's a Ponzi scheme. It's basically a method of bribing the unions and keeping them happy. And I remember when the Bureau of Workers' Compensation was doing refunds, was giving money back because they had so much money in the fund, they didn't know what to do with it all. And the unions were angry because they said, that's our money. That's our money. No, it isn't your money. It's the money of the businesses who contributed to the system. And
well, yes and no. I mean, when you look at it from the administration's position, once the money's in hand, it does become their money, right?
Well, the whole idea is that it socialized workers' compensation. It is, we all know the system is rife with fraud, Barry, and that's kind of the whole point, yes, of this lawsuit. There have been companies that have been hit with such unbelievable fees that they've gone bankrupt. Well, the job of the state is not to set up socialized systems to keep one segment of the workers happy so that there are other segments of the workers who are unhappy because there's no company for them to work at.
Right.
And that is what has gone on with the workers' compensation system. Now, the fact is that the state legislature needs to do things like exempt family-owned businesses who are never going to be able to file a claim. Now, I told that to an auditor who came here. I said, you and I both know you'll never let me. Oh, certainly, sir. If you hurt yourself on the job, we would let you collect. And I'm like, okay, name five businesses that are family-owned where someone in that business, family-owned and operated, where someone in that business has collected and didn't have to go through 2 or 3 years worth of heartache and hearings and paperwork to get it. Well, of course, well, I can't answer that question, sir. Of course you can't answer it because there aren't any. And that's kind of the bottom line, Barry. The fact is that all you have to do is go down, I'm trying to remember what street that's on, Marconi, where the headquarters is, the glass and marble edifice. I think it's on Marconi Boulevard. But to see what they do with the money. We also had the whole CoinGate Beanie Baby debacle, where those kinds of things were they had all these investments in Beanie Babies and quote unquote rare coins. It didn't work out so well. In fact, I think somebody ended up going to jail over that. Tom Noe, correct?
Yes, he did, as a matter of fact.
And that had to do with workers' comp funds. In fact, you know, Barry, what they did when it became clear that money was lost?
They raised the premium rates.
They raised the premium rates. Yep.
Of course. That's the only thing to do is we can't have a net deficit of money. Now, the interesting thing is the BWC has put up a $420 million pot as part of the settlement in order to pay out claims. Now, there's a couple catches to the claim. So there's two problems with this, with the fund. If you are entitled to $10 or less as a claimant, you're not eligible for repayment. And it's also the cost of attorney's fees and the claims administrator for the fund are going to, and a special master to oversee the claims administrator, are all appointed and paid out of the fund. Now, those two, the master and the claims administrator, are capped at $2 million apiece, but the attorney's fees are not capped. So, therefore, $420 million may be an awful lot less by the time businesses come around to claim it. And the other little catch is any unclaimed money is returned to the Bureau. Again, it's our money. We're just going to let you get access to it.
Well,
is what the Bureau is saying.
Basically, what's going to have to happen is you're going to have to realize that you've been overcharged and file a claim. They're not going to come to you and say, you know, we overcharged you.
Well, and you know what, Chuck? That's right. That's exactly how they're going to do it, because that's how they're doing it in another agency. And we're going to be talking about that here as soon as I can get over to this page. Okay, and this is a headline out of today's Dispatch. You know, it's been an excellent source of fodder for today. I hate to say it.
Yeah.
Because there's an article on the front page of the Dispatch today, ex-tax official failed to refund millions to Ohio businesses. Now, what's happened is this employer, Rick Anthony, former Deputy Tax Commissioner Rick Anthony pleaded guilty for failing to refund more than $30 million in tax overpayments to businesses in Ohio over a number of years. But, you know, he was fined $750 today in Franklin County Municipal Court. You know, that's great and well, except for the fact that, you know, he probably has cost those businesses much more money because of the lack of ability to utilize that money for, you know, buying equipment or hiring employees or, you know, improving their output. $30 million is not a little bit, but there was a quote in the article that basically said the department's standard operating procedure is that if someone doesn't ask, they don't tell them that they've overpaid. And therefore, if it goes for, I believe it's 4 years of overpayment, not being claimed, then that money reverts to the state.
Well, that's unfortunately pretty typical. And in fact, there are other things like that now. For instance, if you put money in a savings account and then don't touch it for a few years,
right.
States used to basically require you, they'd send you a letter and say, are you still alive? Is this your account? Blah, 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 blah. Now they just seize it. A lot of states have gone over from a kind of a passive, you know, if it hasn't moved in 10 years and, you know, we don't hear anything, we'll assume that it's an abandoned account. And unless we hear something and you have X number of years to come in and claim the money, now they just move in and seize the account. So if you put money in the bank, and sometimes it's as little as 2 years, you put money in the bank and don't touch it for 2 years, you may find suddenly that on your statement that it's not there. Well, and you go to your bank and they'll say, well, we had to turn it over. You hadn't, you know, the state seized it.
Yeah, you hadn't used it.
Yeah. So therefore it's our money. Well, that's the attitude that's kind of taken hold here. The idea is that somehow any money that was accidentally overpaid belongs to us. Well, no, it doesn't. I'm sorry, no, it does not. It belongs to the person who overpaid it. And it's your duty But we don't live in an era of duty anymore, Barry. We live in an era of people who are busy lining their own nests. I have to laugh about this because this guy, first of all, the fine that he paid is a joke. $750. He paid $750 fine for failing to refund.
$750. Now, you have to take this in context. Now, he had retired from that $30 million. You have to think about it this way. He had retired from the Department of Taxation, and then he was given another job as a member of the Ohio Casino Control Commission.
He had
to step down from that $109,000+ a year job earlier this summer.
That's just too good. I mean, it's too ironic to even think about. He went from one pickpocket operation to another pickpocket operation. I mean, that's almost just too good. And
something like that. Yeah, because we know the casinos don't earn back money that they overcharge the customers.
Never. Well, it's not even that. Look, the whole gambling thing, some people think it's great fun to go waste money. Okay, whatever. And take a chance on beating the house. Whoever beats the house. I mean, it happens on occasion. We all hear about the person who won $500,000 at a slot machine or whatever. Or occasionally somebody who cleans up playing poker or the roulette wheel or something. How often does it happen?
And let's just think about it this way. They don't build those block-long, big, opulent buildings because they're giving away money.
Well, and also what's happening in some of these gambling casinos are, for instance, in Atlantic City is closing casinos because nobody's going there to gamble anymore. They're all going to Cleveland or they're all going to Columbus or they're all going down to Lawrenceburg, Indiana. Why have to drive all the way to Atlantic City when you can go to these places and waste your money there rather than waste your money in Atlantic City or Las Vegas? You know, they're all feeling the pinch, but that's not the point here. The point is that, everybody knows that the house rakes it in, and the house has agreed as a matter of paying a protection fee. And I hate to put it this way, but this is what it is, as a matter of paying a protection fee to protect their monopoly, as we saw with the closure of the quote-unquote games of skill places. I think last year a number of those places were suddenly closed after the legislature bent over backwards to legalize them. Basically, as a protection of their monopoly, that they agree to rake off a piece of the profit and send it to the state. Now, the fact that so many people become addicted to gambling and problem gambling is a major problem in this country. Again, the law of unintended consequences, and you can't make this stuff up. You go from stealing $30 million in tax overpayments and paying a $750 fine to going to work for legalized theft from quote-unquote watchdogging businesses that are licensed to steal, because that's what they do. Now, I know we'll get kickback from people who, well, I love to gamble. I think it's fun. Whatever. That's between you and God, how you use the provision that God provides, and some people think that's great entertainment to go in and lose a bunch of money. I don't. And I also have had long and drawn out conversations with people who tell me that gambling isn't a sin. Okay, whatever. You may believe that, and it's not directly prohibited, but it's certainly you can derive that prohibition from the things God says about for instance, the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not covet, thou shalt not steal. And I'm just kind of taken aback by the fact that a judge thought that $750 was a good enough fine for stealing $30 million.
He didn't actually steal it. They just made sure that the state didn't lose it. So therefore, I'm surprised that he actually had to pay a fine. I would have thought that he probably would have been given a bonus.
You know, but Barry, I'm going to tell you, we did two shows in a row about nuance. And
yes,
that particular thing, is a we are basically out of time, but that is one of those situations where that is a nuanced position. Taking money that belongs to someone else and keeping it for yourself is stealing.
Keeping it for the employer you work for. That's it.
Like I said, we are out of time. I would ask that you join us again next week for another Principles and Policies, where we hope we won't have to deal with more of these ironic situations.
But really, you just can't make these things up.
You can't make them up. Join us again next week.